And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io.
And we're back for another episode of the Startup Hustle. This is your host, Matt Watson. Very excited to be joined by Jason Cohen today, who's the Chief Innovation Officer of WP Engine. Almost anybody who works in tech or marketing knows who WP Engine is. They're one of the largest WordPress hosting websites. Jason probably give us the exact number, but something like super high percentage of the entire internet runs on WP Engine. So very excited to talk to him today. Do want to remind everybody that today's episode is brought to you by Fullscale. If you need help doing software development, front end, back end, mobile QA, whatever it is, you can check us out at fullscale.io. Jason, welcome to the show, man.
Yeah, it's awesome to be here.
So you were also the founder, or one of the founders, of SmartBearer a long time ago. And I'm curious if you could tell us a little bit about SmartBearer and the origin of that. And we have a weird connection you don't know about with that that I'll tell you later.
Okay. I started SmartBearer 22 years ago. So you can let that sink in. Okay. And originally it was me learning .NET, and I had this insight that there's a lot of information inside version control systems that we don't get out of the version control system. I felt like version control systems are write many, read never, except for just making sure we have the same copy of the code. And so I realized there's stuff you could do in there that might be interesting. Like, let's suppose you're going to go change a line of code and it's not been changed for 10 years and you're changing it. You know, like, would that give you pause? Would you maybe get someone to look over it for you? Would you investigate more? Would you write more tests? That sort of thing. Versus something where obviously everyone's working on it right now. It's fast moving. And so I wouldn't. So that was the kind of insight that I was doing. What ended up happening is people would abuse these tools for code review, meaning software developers reviewing each other's work, just like authors and editors do, to find mistakes or teach new people how stuff works, or work with remote teams where you're not physically there, but you want to somehow talk about code. That's what people really wanted to do. So it ended up being that code review process was the one thing that people really wanted. And so eventually the other products faded away, meaning we got rid of them. And so what became Code Collaborator was the main product. So this was a bootstrap company. I sold it in 2007. I left in 2009. That company is still going today, still called SmartBearer. It was sold in 2020 for over $2 billion. And that was before the craziness of 22. And actually the valuation was quite reasonable, because the company, and this was in the public statements about it, it was about $150 million in revenue, but half of that is bottom line profit.
Wow.
That's amazing, right? So it actually sold for something like 20 to 24 times revenue. I mean, sorry, times profit, like free cash flow. And that's a very reasonable, normal thing for a company to sell for. So actually the valuation is perfectly justifiable. It was very profitable when I was running it too. And the strategy continued to be when I was gone, since of course, almost all of that happened after I was gone, right? And I can't take credit for that. But the strategy was, it's throwing off cash, so go buy other small but profitable development tools, products, particularly in the quality space, like code quality. And so you sort of amass these things. And so it's almost like a leverage buyout without the leverage, because you're generating the cash. And so that was the idea. And so it was a successful idea. That wasn't my idea. That was the idea of the when I sold it. That was the idea. And they were very successful with that. So that's the full story of SmartBearer. And then since I started writing a blog while I was there, my online name became A Smart Bear from that. And to this day, I have that handle.
Yes. So it turned out into kind of a private equity roll-up kind of kind of investment vehicle, right, afterwards. And So one of my previous startups actually ended up being in their crosshairs at one time. So I actually went to the Smart Bear offices once and had like M&A conversations. It was a few, you know, several years ago. So we have that weird connection. We ended up selling the company to a company called Netreo a few years later. But so that was just kind of irony of us doing this today. But what I love is, so you started out, you were a software developer. You were more technical, right? You were a .NET developer. I was also a .NET developer, by the way. We don't have to tell anybody else. This is a safe space. So at what point in your career did you go from software developer to CEO, or today are you still hands-on technically even today?
Well, at SmartBear, that's what I did. So I guess it was early that I did that. Now, that doesn't mean I stopped writing code. At SmartBear, I did stop writing code. But then after that, you know, again, now fast forwarding years, now it's 2010. My wife has had a baby. I've been a stay-at-home dad for a year. I start getting itchy. I start making stuff. And so I kind of go back into that maker mode at WP Engine, where I am now. So WP Engine was started in 2010. So then I was back to being, the CEO, but if there's only you, then like the CEO title is not really important. So of course I'm doing all the things. So to this day, I'm heavily involved in the product and engineering side of WP Engine. But yeah, I haven't, I almost never write code that goes anywhere in production. The last time I was doing that really full-time at WP Engine was probably 12 years ago. Maybe 10 years ago, maybe.
So tell us, what led you to the idea of WP Engine? I'm going to guess you were trying to build a website and very frustrated. And you're like, I have to solve this problem. That would be my guess, but.
Sort of. So again, it's at SmartBear, I started a blog, which I still write on today. So it's been around for a long time. And what would happen is I'd get on the front page of Hacker News and then it would crash. Because you get at the time, maybe 15 hits per second for 15 minutes. That was like kind of the rough numbers when you hit the front page of Hacker News then, 15 years ago. And so I would call up other people that use WordPress, which was the blogging software, open source blogging software that I was using. Then probably the most popular blogging software, definitely today it is. And said, what do you do to keep WordPress running when this happens? And the answer was always, I don't know, but if you find something, tell me, because I need that, you know? So it was like a thing I needed, but also there was something out there. Now, we all know, just because you have an idea and just because you have the problem does not mean you have a business.
Yeah.
It means you have a spark, which is nice. Sparks are good. There's some reason why you understand it or you have an insight and you might be onto something, but so many things are required for the business to be real. Other people have to, in fact, have the problem. Enough other people have to have the problem. Even if you just want a solo company all by yourself, it still takes a surprising number of people to have the problem because not all of them will find out about you, especially when you're small. So you need quite a lot of people who actually have the problem and they agree they have the problem because you'll find people have it and they're like, eh. And they have to want to spend money to solve it, another barrier that eliminates a lot of people. And actually have a budget to do that and actually decide to spend the budget, you know, like, okay, we're coming up on a decision point. They have to say at some point or else you don't get the sale. And are there competitors? Why you? And so there's just, how are you going to market? How are you going to get attention? If it's a tiny market, that's bad because there's not many people there. If it's a large market, oh good, that proves there's demand. But then how are you going to get attention in a large market with lots of players and some are well-known and spend a lot of money and some aren't and some are funded and some aren't. Okay, but that's busy. How are you going to get in there? What's special about you? How are you going to get attention? You don't have any money. So that's not even all the things. That's just some of the things besides a good idea that's required for the business to be real. So what I did is I talked to 50 potential customers, 50. It took 4 months because anyone that's done this knows it takes a long time to find them and get them on the phone. And, you know, it's really hard actually. And did these interviews to try to figure out, is this germ of an idea the rest of these questions, can they be answered more or less to the positive? And I actually had a different idea, which I was validated, or I should say invalidated. It wasn't good enough. It didn't hit on all those enough. But then the idea for WP Engine, which is manage WordPress platform. Now it's a lot more than that because we have very popular tools, like some of the most popular tools in WordPress. So now it's more than just hosting. But originally it was just managed WordPress hosting, which means we make WordPress-based websites fast and scalable and secure. And then our tech support actually answers questions about WordPress instead of just saying the server's up, the internet's up, so we're done. So that was the original idea. You're paying GoDaddy $5 a month for WordPress. Instead, you pay us $50 a month, 10 times as much. But we do those four things: make it fast, scale, security, service. And a lot of people wanted that trade of spending more and getting those things. So I used a specific technique to do those interviews to invalidate the one idea, validate that one. So that's the whole like beginning, much more organized than at SmartBear, much more intentional. And I think that's why I was able to invalidate an idea that was a fine idea, just not good enough. And then WP Engine, which of course is good enough. We are now a unicorn. We have over 1,000 people. We have 200,000 customers. As you say, we power a non-trivial amount of the internet. So that being really intentional about whether the idea was good, at least in this case, paid off. And I wouldn't say it's proof that all the ideas are right always, but you know, okay, it seemed to work.
Well, so WordPress itself is like what, 70, 80% of the internet or something is on WordPress? Like what is the number?
I'm sure. 80% of all domains, but it's more than half of everything that uses a CMS.
Yeah. And you guys have what of that market share?
We have about 2.5% of every website, like not WordPress.
Okay.
I mean, just websites.
It's a lot of websites.
Yeah. Well, it's the internet is almost infinity big. Like, you know, yeah. So like 2% of something that's, you know, closer to infinity than zero is a big number.
So I'm curious so when you guys started out, you're like, look, we're going to do specialization around WordPress. Were there other people that were doing specialization around WordPress itself?
There was one company that was doing something similar. And then right around the same time that we were, another company popped up. Didn't know about that till after we started, but we were about the same time. And that was it. Now there's, you know, there's dozens of competitors. I mean, now it's a very busy, busy thing because we showed that it's a big market.
And lots of non-WordPress competitors too, like Wix and Squarespace and all this other junk. There's never-ending list of things. So, So I'm curious, how did you figure out how to grow the company? And I asked this question. The thing I always remember is one of my friends is a creative guy, web designer. And of course, somehow or another, he got one of your shirts that says my website is like four times faster, whatever it is. I don't remember exactly what it said.
That's right.
So I'm curious, is that what it said?
Yeah.
So I'm curious, what was the key to your go-to-market strategy that made you guys like really grow and really take off, you know, above and beyond your competitors and become where you were today? Was it the shirts?
The shirts were good. I have to say, we also had one that said fireball proof. And nowadays no one would know what that means. But at the time, Daring Fireball was one of the most popular blogs that there was. He wrote about Apple stuff, but famously he would, if anyone had a WordPress site and he linked to them, their site would definitely crash because he was so popular, right? And then he would make fun of them, and he'd always specifically make fun of WordPress for not being scalable. So you got fireballed, and it was kind of a thing that you knew that WordPress couldn't be fireballed. So our thing was your fireball proof, right? So at South by Southwest in 2010 or 2011, that was good marketing. Now it would be bad marketing. You know, no, that's not the reason we grew, though. First of all, we were really good at execution. A lot of engineers just make features and just stay inside Visual Studio, and you're wrong. And so people that do that, then people who actually bother with marketing or channels or positioning or calling customers or trying to figure that out or even using tech support for that, they'll win. Yeah, as simple as that. Because people who haven't bought it yet aren't buying because of the features or even the bug fixes. They don't even know the bugs are there. So that's not why they're finding you. So we had good execution, first of all. The second thing is we were really good at interfacing with people in the WordPress community. That by that I mean some of that I mean people who had plugins or other software for WordPress themes, but mostly agencies who built sites on behalf of clients. So by talking to them, they knew who we were. We would do things like go to meetups where the agencies would come to, and we gave out free basic small accounts to agencies just to see who we are, try it out, blah, blah, blah. And then when they saw, oh yeah, this is really fast. I don't know, maybe I'll try it with a client. And once you went over an agency, that's a big win because agencies keep making sites so they can keep bringing customers. So it's an N squared growth thing to go through a channel like an agency as opposed to direct, which is like big O N with your marketing spend. So you can see why that would be more effective. That explains our growth in the first 18 months, which was healthy. Then we really exploded, like went to hyper growth phase, which we never got out of. Like we never stopped growing that fast. It's hard to say what really caused that one moment because life is not an experiment you can run again. So it's hard to say, like if you do 10 things and you have hypergrowth, it's really hard to attribute it to any one thing. Like, well, what if we didn't do two of them? Would we still have had it? I don't know that one can really know that unless you go back in time. And so with the caveat that it's hard to say, one of the big things we did simultaneous with that explosion is we changed pricing. We changed pricing because we were listening to customers. We were reacting to what customers said. It wasn't capricious. And so you could maybe argue that was that turned the curve. And at the time, we had a few things in our pricing that no competitor had. There were only two, but still the other competitors didn't do it. They later followed suit and did it. And so did others who came. So perhaps everyone was just copying us, but perhaps those really were good ideas and does explain it. One of those things is we lowered the price at the lowest plan from $50 to $29. And the reason is agencies would say, look, I got clients at GoDaddy, they're paying $2, $3 a month. Now I can get them to pay a lot more. They get it that, you know, pay more, site goes faster, you get ranked higher in Google rankings and people don't bounce off the page. I can convince them of that. I can get them to pay like 10 times as much. But beyond that, it's really hard. Like I can't get them past 10. If you can just give me something in that $20 range with a 2 on it instead of a 5 on it, like I can get a lot more. So we heard that sort of message from the agencies. The second thing was you only get one website for each plan. So even if you spend $1,000 a month, that's for one website. But we had agencies or actually even just individual people saying, look, I have a big website. I'm happy to pay you $100 a month for it. But I have this little one for my mom that doesn't get any traffic. Can I just put it on you? Like, do I really have to keep this other account open or can I just, you know? So we ended up having, okay, you can have up to 5, up to 10, up to whatever number of sites per plan. That was the next thing. Another thing we did, which I think is applicable today for anyone to try, is this. We had a 15-day free trial. Free is actually pretty amazing in hosting. Like usually you have to put in the credit card and you don't get it for free in the world of selling CPUs. But we did it anyway because I thought, you know, it's a technique for people to, again, to see how good the product is, and then that would sell itself in a sense. So what I saw is that more than 90% converted to paid. And what that means is they weren't really trying it. They were already deciding. And so I thought, okay, I'm just losing 2 weeks of revenue then. And again, we're bootstrapped at this point still. Now we've raised a bunch of money, but then we were bootstrapped. I don't want to lose 2 weeks of revenue. So I thought, okay, but I do want to give people some kind of out, in part because I want them to not have that be a barrier to sign up, but in part because I think it's the right thing to do. You know, you have buyer's remorse. It's okay. You know, so we replaced the 2 week free trial with a 60-day money back guarantee. And that's all it said. Like it didn't explain how, and I don't know. And I expected signups to go down, like number N signups to go down, but that they would stay. Like I expected those 90% to still sign up. And in fact, signups went up. And when I talked to people about it, I said, what changed your mind? They're like, well, before I only got 15 days to try it. I didn't feel like that was enough. Now I have 60 days to try it. See, they were focused on the number of days, not the fact that the credit card be charged on this date or on that date. That's not what they were concerned about, which surprised me. I thought they would. So that was great. So actually changing it to that more permissive in days, but actually less permissive in terms of if you stay, I got more money earlier, you know, that actually helped sign up. So interesting thing for people to try. I mean, who knows? I mean, different times and different markets, different consumers, clearly they'll have different behavior, but it's an interesting idea for people to play with these types of things on the front end because it did make a difference for us.
Well, as you mentioned, it's probably 10 different things that you did, right? And it's hard to know which of those was the magic thing that was critical to your success. I'm still going to say it was the free shirt that my friend Mel got. I saw a shirt. I signed up for WP Engine and I told somebody else. So I'm taking credit for it.
Shirts are good. I mean, I don't know now in post COVID if they're good, but back then when people would go around, also back then, South by Southwest, people really did go. I mean, this was just like a year or two after Twitter launched and Foursquare launched at South by, you know, Uber. Like, it was a place where people actually went and neat companies launched or had big announcements. And so having a shirt around stuff like that was cool. Nowadays, not so sure about that.
So over the last 14 years or so that you've been doing this, how much has WordPress changed?
Well, everything's changed. What has changed in 14 years of tech? I mean, there's nothing that hasn't changed.
Well, specifically about WordPress, like what about WordPress has changed that has affected your guys' business?
Well, I mean, it's kind of hard to answer that. So many things. I mean, the plugin ecosystem is so mature now. Like, arguably the best SEO tools in the world are in WordPress in the form of Yoast, for example. So that's really helpful. There's so many successful websites on WordPress that the social proof of like, can WordPress do it? It's like, are you kidding? Like, here's this huge slate of websites that you've heard of, you know, that are that have used WordPress for a decade. So yes, you know, like, what else do you want to know? So the new, I mean, I say new, it's like 6 years old now, but you know, in this time frame, I guess it's new. The new editor, originally codenamed Gutenberg, now just the WordPress editor. You know, that's a really big deal. It creates a whole new way for people to make composable things for layouts as well as content. WordPress used to not be so good for layouts in terms of the marketers being able to do it.
Yeah.
Now the marketers can do it. So now you can make like a dozen landing pages in an afternoon by yourself and not talk to a designer, not talk to a developer. That's really powerful. So that's been great. I mean, it's hard to condense 14 years into what changed.
Well, so as the chief innovation officer, what are you focused on today? Are you focused more on headless, or like, what is the big thing that you're focused on now?
Yeah, about 3 or 4 years ago, we launched a headless product, exactly. And I was working on that at the time. So I worked on that for a few years. Right now I'm working in the last couple of years, we've rethought our corporate strategy. So I worked a lot on that. And now at our size, a lot of what I do is helping other people to do things rather than having direct responsibility over an area. So whether it's something in data or corporate data, we obviously have AI stuff that we've launched and that we continue to do work on. Headless is still an important new product line for us. So there's various areas that I contribute to. And it's a little bit nebulous what I'm saying, but I don't think you want, at scale especially, you can't have a company full of free electrons zipping around and ripping things apart. But if you have one or two and there's a reason, like being a founder is a reason, then it can be actually quite powerful to have someone who has the view across the business and the historical context as well, who can help without taking control away from someone, taking decisions away and so forth.
So can you explain to us what headless is and maybe how people use headless WordPress, like specific use cases for it?
Yeah. So the general, unfortunately, the word is kind of weird. Decoupled would be a better word, but everyone says headless. So, so fine. But as an engineer, decoupled makes more sense. And it's simply that WordPress is a monolith that does lots of stuff. And it does everything from allowing marketers to draft content, publish it, work with social media things, tag things, do searches over them, make landing pages and other kinds of campaign stuff as opposed to the main website. It kind of goes on and on what WordPress does. And one of the things it does is it actually serves up the content. Like if someone hits the homepage, something's got to render the HTML and serve up the static assets and so forth. WordPress does that too. So the general idea of any decoupled architecture is, hey, maybe we should use the right tool for each job rather than one monolith, which may be not very good at each job. And so let's split it up. And so the good news is you can have the right tool for the job. So an obvious one for statics is a CDN. Of course, everyone's been doing that, you know, all along. Okay, but it's a good example. And in particular, if the part where you're rendering the content for the browser, rendering the HTML, that part, if you separate it from WordPress, it's like you quote unquote cut off its head, like its face.
Yeah.
And that's why it's headless. So WordPress as the CMS, content management system, meaning, again, the place where the marketers go to manage content, do most of the things I just listed. But the face, the part that renders, that's the part you pull away and say, no, we're going to give that to Node because Node.js is better at that. These front-end frameworks are better at that, blah, blah, blah. And so we're going to do that and scale it that way and use things like React and use things like Next and, you know, and so forth. That's how we're going to do our front ends. And WordPress, you'll be an API to content. We want the content, which we do. It's a web, it's a marketing website. We want content everywhere. We'll ask you WordPress via API and you'll tell us. So WordPress is still the face to the marketer, but Node.js or something like that is the face to the rest of the world. That's in general what's meant by headless. Usually you have other components too, though. You are often decoupling things like e-commerce and other stuff, analytics and so on. Often there's a lot of things decoupled. The good news is it is true that these components are better for each job because they're specialized. The bad news is now you have a whole bunch of components and they're all yapping at each other. And we all know as engineers, integration is really, really hard. It's hard to test. It's hard to scale. And when something goes wrong, that can be really hard to diagnose. And what if all these components are owned by different vendors and you're trying to talk to their support and, you know, and also they're all charging you in different ways for how you're using the component? That sucks. So there's these penalties of being decoupled as well. And so our product, I'm not here to sell it, but the value proposition of our headless product is it is decoupled in that there's these different pieces because you want the right tool for the job. But since you've bought all the pieces from us, there's only one vendor to call. There's only one place for troubleshooting. There's only one support team that you have to rely on. There's only one invoice you get, right? Like we can shave off some of the problems that you get out of decoupled. So that's why if you're building a decoupled or headless WordPress site, we are the best place for those components.
So you mentioned AI. What are you guys doing with AI?
I mean, there's so much going on there, and I'm sure you don't want to turn this into an AI freaking discussion, right? But especially with large language models, of course, it's obvious everyone wants to use AI to write stuff on the web. And you have this kind of problem of like, but Google's probably going to ding you for it, which they've already started doing. So is there an arms race there? What is the right way to use it that way? Can you use it, for example, to help you something you've written be better for SEO or take something you've written and expand it or give you a draft that you then fix? I mean, there's lots of ways of leveraging AI to be more efficient or more intelligent in writing copy. Maybe cutting it up into cutting up an article into things that you tweet or other kinds of formats like that. That's a good one. But there's other kinds of that's just in writing. Then there's stuff in site capabilities which are interesting. So for example, a lot of websites have their own little search bar to search for stuff, especially media or e-commerce, right? Often not other things, but those there are good uses for it. They're almost always crap. Like if you try to use it, it's not very good. You often go to Google and type the name of the domain in just to get like a relevant result. But when they're good, that can be very powerful for the site. For example, in e-commerce, we have just by reference, we have over 20,000 stores, like e-commerce stores, that do considerable revenue. Like not, we have hundreds of thousands that are trivial, but we have like 20,000 that really do substantial revenue. On those, any visitor that goes to a search box, just clicks in the search box, no matter what they do next, is 3 times more likely to buy. This kind of makes sense. Like they coming in with intent, maybe they're looking for a specific. So it's not like illogical or something, but you might not know that's the number. And when you do know that, then you say, well, what search experience would you like to deliver to that person? Like, oh my gosh, like it's probably worth having amazing experience right there because this is such a high quality person now that just, you know, so you want that result to be incredible. It's worth having a good search experience. In other words, like worth it in dollars, especially with e-commerce, but also media. So to the extent that AI can make the searches better, which of course it can, that actually can result in more revenue for e-com or more hits for media, like directly, which in terms of and more hits in media, of course, also means more revenue for their business model. So it really can better search, oddly enough, can equal more revenues, which is a phrase that may not make sense until you connect all the dots. Another thing I like to say, just as a vision statement for AI in just in the area of search alone, is if I type a search term, or if I make a search and hit enter, and you give me five results that are very good, that's great. But even better is if you were to just write the article I wish you had written in the first place, perhaps using those five results, as those are relevant, you know, but like whatever I wanted when I was searching, if you just literally write that for me, let me tune the length, let me ask follow-up questions, like I'm going to have exactly what I need instead of still pawing through, let's say, five articles about it. So there's still like a lot of interesting ideas of like, how do people even use the web? Because is that even search? Not really. It's an evolution of the search box, yeah. But at some point it's not even right to call it search. Just like an organism might evolve so much. That's not even really what it is anymore, even if that's where it came from. It's not clear how the web will continue to evolve with these capabilities, right? It's not obvious. So we're trying to be on the forefront of some of that. So we can help shape what that is, but ultimately none of us are in control of what happens with that, I think.
So are you focused more on then extending beyond WordPress's base functionality? Like you guys are building a lot of custom stuff to help take WordPress, you know, augment on top of WordPress then?
We always have. I mean, from the very beginning, that's the whole value proposition is WordPress is great. Now, what can we add to it? Well, to this day, we don't change any line of code in WordPress. We're not here to, I don't know, fork it or modify the project. We want to contribute to it, but right. Just in the normal way that everyone would get. No, the whole point is to build things on top. And those things are development tools for developers or tools for marketers or now the AI stuff or this headless constellation of other thingies that are in fact not WordPress, but, you know, work together to make a website. So yeah, it's always been that way.
So I'm curious, one thing I read in one of your blogs was about focus and doing too much. And I'm curious, over your guys' history, how have you had to battle against that, against maybe doing something besides WordPress, or, you know, what you do within WordPress, be it e-commerce or these things, versus, you know, how do you deal with that staying focused, especially as the chief innovation officer?
Yeah, no, it's actually pretty easy not to go too far astray. What's hard is the number of things which are in our area of like the right market, the right stuff, that we still have too many ideas. That could be hard. But I've always said from the beginning, like, you know, we'll never say never, never say you'll never go beyond WordPress, but it's called WP Engine and the WordPress.
Yeah.
And so the reason that can be easy in our case is the market is so big that unless you're dominating the market, and dominating could even mean 10% of the WordPress market, you know, like in a market that large, you could argue that even at 10% penetration, you could say, look, no one's going to have 60. So 10% is actually pretty high relative to what it's possible for someone to get. And so you're going to need to go elsewhere. You could make that case, right? So you have to judge for yourself what kind of penetration level means it's time to add on another entire line that goes outside the market. This is the thing that any company at scale has to think about. WordPress has always been so big and other things are so small. So like the classic question we got is why not Drupal? Because Drupal is the same tech stack. It's still PHP and MySQL and blah, 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 blah. But the answer is, well, Drupal is like a 20th the size of WordPress and not growing as fast. And there's already two great competitors over there. So even if we were to quote unquote dominate that market, it really wouldn't change us very much. And we wouldn't, because there's two great players there. So why would we dominate that? It doesn't make any sense. One of them is the founder of Drupal. Like, it doesn't make any sense that we dominate that. Like, it's just illogical. So no, we're not going to go do Drupal. So as an example. Now, how in general do you think about expansion? This is how I do it. And I haven't written about this yet. So here's new stuff. I use this idea of adjacencies, and here's what I mean. If you don't, so once you have some scale, once you've got something going and now it's like, when do we expand and in what way? One of the main rules of strategy is that you have to leverage the strengths and assets that you have. It might be a natural strength, like as people or an organization, or maybe you've built it up. So for example, one of our assets is we have 200,000 customers that are happy with us. Okay, well, then if you make a product they actually want, you can sell into your base and that's an asset, right? So you have to leverage your strengths and assets, of course, like it's kind of obvious to say. So what does that mean at scale? It means you don't want to go into a line of business that's too far afield of what you're doing, or else you're not leveraging the assets and strengths that you have, right? You want to go into something that's adjacent or nearby through some definition of nearby. So here's how I define that. I take the capabilities or departments of the company. So you might say sales, marketing, support, product, engineering. You might put in finance. And depending on the company, you might add something like design, or depending on the company, you might not have sales in there. So tune this to whatever the company has like a concentration in, okay? And these are the buckets of things that you're capable of doing now. So hence the word capabilities. And then with this idea you have for expansion, like do Drupal in our case, right? Or you know, do headless, or you know, right? These are ideas.
Yeah.
What you do is you go to each bucket and you ask, if we did this, how would this bucket have to change? And you only have three choices. Choice one is just trivial, sort of like we just added a feature, like the amount of change. We add a feature, we send out an email to support, maybe we update a knowledge base, like that level of like basic running the business stuff. That's the trivial level. The second level is that there's a major change. So like, we're going to need a training program. We're going to have to like put the sales team through a training program. We're going to need new slides for them to explain what it is, and this sort of thing. That's the second level of change, amount of change. And the third is like an overhaul. And what this means is we're going to have to redo our platform, or we'll probably have to hire new people in sales because it's so different that we can't just train and wait. Or you could say marketing with brand or tech support and so forth, right? So that's like this overhaul is like, is it really like a new business, you might say, a new thing. So that's it. Because it's only those three, it's usually not too hard to say what it is. This doesn't take a lot of analysis and arguing. You can do it pretty fast. And then there's no like rule about exactly what it is. But in general, the more it's not trivial, the more it's not adjacent, the more you're not leveraging what you have, yeah. You're having to change stuff. And especially overhauls, like even one overhaul, you might argue is too much, but maybe not, because what if it's an enormous opportunity? Okay, it might be worth an overhaul or two, but still not three or four, because it's too much risk. Like when you say overhaul, the chance that you get that right or get it right within 6 months as opposed to 3 years, super low. So it's not just the investment in time. It also is that it's also the risk. And it's also the fact that you're not leveraging something. So it's almost definitionally not as good of a strategy. So it had better be an amazing thing if you're entering like that. So with that general line of thinking, you can evaluate different ways to expand. And pretty soon, or pretty easily, you get to go, okay, there's a few ways which, okay, they're not the biggest ideas, but they're really low risk going into this country. Okay, we have to hire people in that country, and that's it. Like, oh, well, that's, as long as the country's big enough, you know, that's pretty good. Now, here's something that may be a little higher risk, but it's really high reward. Therefore, we want to do it. And by the way, we have to agree to invest in whatever we said in there. So that's going to cost us millions of dollars. We're going to have to commit to that and do that and have a plan for the year for that, blah, blah, blah. In other words, it still sets you up for like, here's the consequences of that. We accept that and we'll do it. So it doesn't tell you exactly what to do, but it's this analysis, but that's almost in quotes because it's so simple, and yet it really helps you see which things are have what consequences. And the final thing about it is it makes it really easy to explain to the whole company later, which is something you forget when you're in these decision frameworks, which is kind of is. You make the decision, but like how easy is it to explain? If the answer is we put everything in this really complicated rubric with formulas everywhere, and this one, you know, option B just gently edged out option G, so we're doing it. That's a really, really bad reason, right? Like, I don't know, what? Like, how's that strategic? How am I going to get confidence behind that? I don't, you know, like, that's often how people do it. It's a terrible way to do it. And that's part of why. Can't explain it, really. Whereas this way, you can. You can say, all right, there's this low-risk way that we're, like, sure is going to help us grow in a new fashion. And then this way that's a little higher risk. And you know what? Hey, sales, guess what? Changes are coming. So buckle up, but here's why it's so exciting. Reasons, reasons, reasons. And we can leverage this stuff because for engineering, it's easy. Reasons, reasons, you know, and like you have this narrative now, like here's why we're making this set of trade-offs. Here's the consequences it'll have for all of us and why it's a good idea. Let's go. Now we're talking. And so it almost suggests what that narrative is going to be.
The hardest part is always getting the salespeople aligned and what the comp plan is.
the comp plan, because if the comp plan's right, they are aligned.
Yeah, it's like my first company. After we were acquired, there was like one of our sister companies would have made perfect sense for us to like resell and partner together. But it never got done because the salespeople couldn't figure out how to align on their comp plan and how to resell the products. Like, it just died. It's like anybody else logic would be like, this makes perfect sense. But no, salespeople are like, I'm not selling that thing. I don't get commission for it. It's like, whole thing died.
Yeah.
So I have I've really, really appreciated having you on the show today. And you're clearly a brilliant entrepreneur and you've been very successful. There was one specific thing I read on your blog that I would love for you to touch on for just a minute or two. And it was your concept of the joy, skill, and need framework. Because I think that's something that all of us really struggle with. And I really liked that framework.
Yeah. So there's a lot of similar frameworks about things like fulfillment. And I'm staying away from the word happy because that's a different thing. But really what this came from is burning out. So at Smart Bear, I burned out. And I didn't even really know it until after I sold it. And then it was clear how unhappy I was. I didn't want that to happen again at WP Engine. So about 4 years in at WP Engine, really growing fast, as I was saying. And there was like a 4 month period where there was a suggestion of like, should I still be the CEO or should I be the CTO, stay in my area of happiness and skill in product and engineering, or do you really want to be the CEO of a fast scaling larger company? And so I decided, again, fast forwarding 4 months, no, I don't want to be the CEO of that. But how do you come up with that decision, especially as the founder? I mean, being the CEO is so, it's like one of the whole reasons to do the company in the first place is so you can be that, have that control, have that position, be able to say that to other people and take credit when the company does well. Like that's part of why you're doing it. So it's a really big decision and a really hard one. So this framework is one I made, which is what I used to make that decision. And it was so effective that afterwards, and then during the transition, I really wanted to explain to everyone at the company why I did this, because I was afraid people would think, this is just an excuse. I'm getting pushed out. This is 1 foot out the door for me. I was afraid people would think that. This is now over 10 years ago, and I'm still at the company. So it's pretty clear that that was not doing it. But at the time, right, that's a good fear. So I really wanted to explain myself to show folks. And so after that, people themselves used it. And so really, I think this is something anyone can use to sort of seek this. And you'll see echoes of things like Ikigai and other things in it. It's not like I made the whole, you know, it's not like this, you can't see this kind of thing elsewhere, because kind of all paths maybe lead to more or less the same place. But the particular one I made was that there's these circles of joy, things you love, meaning like when you do it all day, you're not even tired. You want to continue doing it. You forget to eat and pee while you're doing it, right? That kind of joy. Skill just means you're good at it. Even you think you're pretty good at it. Even you think, I don't have imposter syndrome with this. I'm actually good at this. Like, right? That's what I mean by skill. Another tip off is other people say, oh my gosh, you're a natural at that. Like, you know, whether they're right or not, maybe you worked really hard. Maybe they're wrong. But anyway, they say that. So that must mean you have some kind of skill. And then finally, what does the company need done? What does the company need to have done? It's critical to do this or else our strategy fails, or this is the next part of our plan or whatever. And so the reason, if you imagine a Venn diagram of these, the reason that's useful is because what I found is if you have two of the three, it forms a specific trap that I had fallen into, where I thought things were good, but they weren't. This is why this particular thing is useful. So for example, if you have the joy and the skill, but the company doesn't need it done, then this is what a lot of indie hackers do every day. Indie hackers are like, I'm good at hacking up software. It's fun. So that's what I do. But what does the company need? The company needs you to work on sales and marketing, but you don't like it. You don't know how to do it. You don't have any money to spend. So you don't. And so you have a project that makes 1K MRR for 3 years. While you call yourself an entrepreneur, but really you have a side project and just a couple people just happen to buy it, which is not a company. And that's because you're in that joy and skill area, but that's not what the company needs you to do. It's a very common trap. Plus, you're the founder. Who's going to tell you not to? And it's your side project. So again, who's going to tell you not to? So it's easy to stay in that trap because it feels good because it's something you like and you're good at. So it's easy to stay there. The second trap, right, is that you have the joy and the company needs it done, but you're not good at it. So an example I like to use here is, which again, a lot of engineers do, I did it, is you say, okay, the company needs marketing. Great. I'm going to try AdWords. I've never done AdWords before. I don't know anything about it. I don't know how much to spend. And so I don't even know how to hire a consultant or someone to run it for me because I don't know how to interview them because I don't understand it. So I am going to learn AdWords for the next 3 months. I'm going to do it. I'm going to become an expert in AdWords. Then I'll decide what to do. Like maybe I'll just run it, or I could then hire someone else to run it because I'll know how to manage them now that I'm the expert. And so for the next 3 months, you work on AdWords. That sounds fun. It's fun to learn something new. And the company does need advertising, so that's good. But of course, you're not good at it. But as a founder, you think you're good at absolutely everything and always make the best decisions. It's false. But again, who's going to tell you otherwise? So what happens is you do AdWords for 3 months and you suck because you don't become expert in AdWords in 3 months. Plus, you had to run everything else in the company. That's not how that works. So you're not very good at it. You're not making good decisions. You still don't know how to hire someone who's good at AdWords. So in other words, you just lost 3 months of time. And the company needed marketing, let's not forget. That's what the company needed. So you hurt the company because you wanted to do it. So that's the joy and skill, but not, or joy and need, but not skill trap. The final one is the burnout one. That's the one where you have the company needs it done and you have the skill to do it, but you don't love it. And so this is the thing where, but it needs done and I can do it. And you're right. That's why it's an easy trap to be in. It needs to be done. And a lot of times you say things like, I don't want to push this on anyone else. I'll do it. This kind of martyrdom or servant leadership, some people like to call it. No, this is just you burning yourself out. Now, every day can't be filled with only the things you love. That's obviously also not true. But if the primary things you're doing are the primary responsibilities are things that you don't love. Again, like maybe you have to, like especially as the smaller the company is, the more you just have to do things. You don't have a choice. You don't have the resources. You don't have the money or the people or the time or whatever. So you kind of have to do it. So early on, you may have no choice but to be in that burnout phase. Okay, but just as long as you're recognizing it's bad, not a, something you want to claw out of in a couple of years, right? You know, this is not a good, healthy place to remain, right? And certainly once you start getting at scale, like we were starting to be at this time, we were, let's say, 80 people or something. Well, at 80 people, there is no like, oh, I have to do it. No one else could possibly, like, no, you could have an 81st person. Like, it's just, there's just, that's just not true, right? And so so that's the burnout trap. So it's, again, it is of course a idealistic thing to say you should always be in the middle, blah, 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 you know, right? Of course. But on the other hand, if we don't write down what the vision statement is for yourself, if the ideal for yourself, then how do you get there? How do you build toward that? How do you change things so that you get there? So it's still worth saying what it is. So that's what I used. And again, like this really is for a founder, I think it's more extreme because you're the last stop for everything. So you kind of have to, like, if no one else does it, you have to.
Yeah.
And also it's hardest for anyone to tell you otherwise. So I do think it's extra hard as a founder, but this to me works really well for anybody, you know, anywhere in the company to try to find a place they're healthy, you might say. And by the way, much more productive for the company because what's better than everyone enjoying what they do and being good at it. And we need that. Like, obviously that's good for the, like just selfishly good for the company, like, right? It's one of those rare cases where this is good for everyone involved. So we should, so if there's someone else at the company, for example, who's burning themselves out doing something that's needed, that's something as a leader, you have to recognize and do something about. So, and then when it, let's say you're hiring someone to replace that, not that that's the only way, but supposing, then you want to hire someone where it's in that joy space too. So like when you're interviewing someone, it's not enough to ask about things that verify the skill. How do you know that they have this heart in it? Yeah. A lot of times you can tell just by how they talk about it, what they get excited about, what they sort of run down and won't stop talking about. But also, like, you shouldn't just wait for that to happen. Not every personality does that either, by the way. So you might want to be more intentional about how you're asking about that. Another kind of tip for how to hire that way in general And also, one of these traps, that, and also one of these traps is about, you don't know how to do it. It's not your skill. And yet the company needs it done. Okay. Like, if you pause there though and say like, all right, it's fine for you to like complain about that, but what do? I can't hire for something I don't understand. So how do I break that logjam? So to answer that question, to like the practical question about that particular thing, as well as this question of how do you find the joy in someone else? Couple of tips for that. One is, when you're interviewing the person, and again, let's suppose it's not your skill area because it's the hardest version, you want to come away with the interview feeling like, oh my God, this person said so many things, has so many good ideas. Even if we don't hire them, we've got to do like half of these. I got pages of notes. I got to do this anyway. When you say that literally, that's a great sign that even though you're not the expert, like you're interested in seeing these particular ideas come to fruition here. You can see that they match your style, your culture, you know, right? And yet this person generated them, so maybe they can do it. That's a good signal. And then one other tip I'll give for that is call their reference checks, or do the reference checks, call their references. Now, of course, references they give will say nice things. So you don't ask, is this person good? They'll say, yes, this is totally useless. Don't even ask. Here's what I ask in the reference check. I say, under what circumstances is this person a freaking unstoppable superstar? Like what culture of the company, what kinds of projects, what kinds of teams, who are the other people? Or maybe they're a loner and the answer is no team. Or like, is it a culture of empowerment, or do they like to be told what to do? So they know if I do this, I'll get a reward. Or they get, you know, like what circumstances makes them thrive, and let them tell you. Of course, you did not tell them what your company's like. You're just getting them to generate that, right? And they'll know. They're like, oh my gosh, this person loves being on a team. They always make the whole team better. So they've got to be on a team of people who are, you know, they'll just tell you. And then I ask the opposite. If you could construct a culture or a circumstance that where this person would be crushed and fail and weep and be upset and be terrible at their job, what would that look like? You're like, oh yeah, if you tell them what to do and always staring over their shoulder, they'll leave, you know, or whatever, right? Like they can easily answer that question on both ends. Never tell them what your company's like. You'll come away with this kind of, it doesn't have to be polls. It doesn't have to be polarized per se, but you'll get this kind of yes and no sort of a bucket of stuff. And of course, you'll have to use your judgment. But now you can be like, all right, the closer your company is to that positive end, you're like, okay, now the reference really has helped me know they might thrive here, or vice versa. And so also that really goes to the fact that so many people will thrive somewhere, but not necessarily with you. And that doesn't mean they're good or bad, or you're good or bad. That's not, of course, what it means at all. It's just a puzzle. And does this puzzle piece fit or not? You know, or does the puzzle piece go somewhere else? The puzzle piece isn't good or bad, and the whole isn't good or bad. Just does it fit, right? And so it's a good way, because for everyone, there's that positive one where they thrive like crazy. And for everyone, there's that way where they're crushed and they're awful, or multiple ways really, right? And so just knowing what it is so you can find out if they're a fit, like it's such a nice, truthful way of saying, will this person fit, without saying like, and that means they're bad or something, like it's not even a relevant word to use, right? So those are ways to hire well and to get around this thing of like, but I don't know, I don't have the skill yet to interview them on the skill basis. How do I still find great talent that's likely to succeed? So, yeah, you're taking a bet, obviously, but like, yeah. How do I make that risk better? Those are very practical ways that I use to do that.
Well, I really appreciate having you on the show today. As a reminder, today's episode is brought to you by Fullscale. It's my company. We have over 300 employees in the Philippines. If you're looking to hire software developers, you can check us out at fullscale.io. If you need help with WordPress, you need a place to host your website, definitely check out WP Engine, Jason Cohen's company. I really, really appreciate having you on the show today. I'm curious, as we run out the show, if you have any other final words of wisdom for other entrepreneurs out there about any form.
I would say face the truth. A lot of times you know the answer, you know the truth, or you know that you're avoiding it, or that you know you're avoiding finding out what it is. And the truth doesn't change if you're not seeking it or not heeding it. It just takes longer before you get there anyways, if at all. And it's better, you'll make better decisions. And even if it's bad, because the truth hurts, even if it's bad and it's emotional and stuff, okay, but like the faster you get through it, the better. And it doesn't matter whether it's about yourself or why the company has a problem, or if you need to like fire someone or something like that. Like, I get it. It doesn't make it better, but at least you get through it faster, and that is better. And so facing the difficult truth, maybe even looking for it, man, every one of us probably every day needs a little shove that way, myself included, right? So this advice is for me as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today, Jason.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it.